So welcome to this afternoon's panel, and our first speaker is going to be John Kirshner, who's from the University of Birmingham, where he is currently doing his PhD, and his thesis topic is John Wollam, and that's what he's going to be talking about this afternoon. Thank you.
All right, so the title of my paper is A More Lively Feeling, The Correspondence and Integration of Mystical and Spatial Dynamics in John Wollam's Travels. Colonial New Jersey Quaker tailor, abolitionist, and minister John Wollam, 1720 to 1772, began a 9-day trek westward to speak with the people of the Native American town of Wyalusing in June of 1763. Wollam questioned the wisdom of his journey because hostilities between Native Americans and British colonists were breaking out on the frontier. However, while camping in the Pennsylvania wilderness en route, he considered his motivations. Quote, love was the first motion, and then a concern arose to spend some time with the Indians that I might feel and understand their life and the spirit they live in. Wollam concluded that the temporal circumstances of his journey were less important than the obedience to God's leading or, quote, motion. This 1763 journey illustrates the way Quaker ministers understood their travels not only to lead them to new geographic areas, but to new understandings of divine purpose. Spiritual and physical journey led to theological and moral formation in the traveling minister, which then led to corporate formation as the experience of the minister was spread to geographically isolated Quaker meeting houses. Jack Marietta's study of mid-18th century Philadelphia area Quakers, argues that reform-minded ministers like Wollam and others were a minority voice who wielded disproportionate power in the corporate reshaping of Quaker identity because they had considerable energy. This paper explicates the relationship between the physical activity of itinerant ministry and the formative effect it had on Wollam's social and theological convictions. Additionally, my research argues that Wollam used the aesthetics of travel to model a spiritually integrated social vision. Thus, the act of the travel itself was understood by Wollam as a prophetic vocation, which often led him into conflict with his own religious community. In short, this paper explores the influence of travel on ethical formation in the 18th century by addressing the formative effects of travel on the traveler, as well as on those visited along the way. The records of Wollam's more than 30 itinerant journeys are found in his journal. As an adult, Wollam would travel as far south as North Carolina, north into Massachusetts, west into the Pennsylvania frontier, and east to England, where he died in York in 1772. All in all, Wollam averaged a month per year away from home, but almost 70% of the content of his journal concerns his travels. The high concentration of itinerant ministry material in his journal is not unique, as 18th century Quaker journalists tended toward greater fullness during periods of travel, but it does reinforce the importance of travel in Wollam's spiritual formation. The journal was a spiritual document intended to teach and shape community identity. Ironically, Wollam's high esteem for the act of travel and the role of the traveling minister can be seen on an occasion while visiting a Quaker meeting in North Carolina in 1757, in which he felt called not to minister against slavery, even though he considered slavery, quote, a great evil. Wollam wrote, quote, here I was silent during the meeting for worship, and when business came, my mind was exercised concerning the poor slaves, but did not feel my way clear to speak. William Tabor contends that the primary task of the traveling minister was to speak only when commanded by God to do so, which sometimes meant speaking very uncomfortable words in a hostile environment, and sometimes meant remaining silent during a meeting called for no other purpose but to listen to what that minister had to say. However, at the end of this particular meeting, Wollam reported, quote, a member of their meeting expressed a concern that had some time lain upon him on account of friends, so much neglecting their duty in the education of their slaves. After this man spoke, many more people spoke on behalf of the condition of slaves amongst them, and at the end of the meeting, an official record was made in the meeting minutes to consider the case of slavery more closely. After he described what happened during the meeting, Woolman wrote in his journal, quote, "The friend who made this proposal hath Negroes. He told me that he was at New Garden, about 250 miles from home, and came back alone, and that in this solitary journey, this exercise in regard to the education of their Negroes was from time to time renewed in his mind." And the next paragraph in the journal describes a similar occasion from Virginia, sandwiched between his memorandum of his journey in North Carolina. And the placement of the second account indicates that Woolman linked these two events together thematically, not chronologically. He wrote, quote, "A friend of some note in Virginia who hath slaves told me that he, being far from home on a lonesome journey, had many serious thoughts about them, and that his mind was so impressed therewith that he believed that he saw a time coming when divine providence would alter the circumstance of those people respecting their condition as slaves." On one hand, it seems like avoidance of responsibility that a slave owner would look to, quote, divine providence to improve the conditions of slaves when emancipating his own slaves would have been a good start. However, Woolman's inclusion of these two occasions back to back, linked together only by perceived growing concern about slavery and the physical act of solitary travel, demonstrates Woolman's understanding of moral formation in the act of travel and the encounter with the divine that could happen at a distance from one's home. Moreover, that these stories took place while traveling in the southern colonies, when he only need look among his neighbors in New Jersey to find slavery, is important to understand the way travel and moral and spiritual formation corresponded in Woolman's experience. John Butler has noted that among the colonies was a religious, the British North American colonies, was a cultural pluralism that dwarfed the mild religious diversity found in early modern European nations. That's Butler's analysis. T.H. Breen has likewise argued that even colonists in moderate proximity often maintained unique habits, forms of government, and constituted diverse ethnic and ideological constituencies. Woolman himself identified the southern colonies as an almost foreign land. Quote, "I had many thoughts on the different circumstances of friends who inhabit Pennsylvania and Jersey and those who dwell in Maryland, Virginia, and Carolina," he said. While friends in New Jersey and Pennsylvania could trace their Quaker roots back to England and lived in a, quote, peaceable way, the southern colonies, he believed, were settled by people of a, quote, warlike disposition, and were an, quote, imperious warlike people supported by oppressed slaves. Woolman believed that the ethnic and religious history of the southern colonies had led to a particularly callous spiritual condition that supported the systemic entrenchment of slavery. The spiritual condition, he said, was as a, quote, dark gloominess hanging over the land, and made it more difficult for those sympathetic to the cause of anti-slavery. For Woolman, travels in the southern colonies, even among Quakers, was as a journey to a very different place with a unique and troubled spiritual and moral culture. As a stranger in a new cultural environment, his perceptions of the spiritual conditions of others and his own understanding of what God required of him were enhanced. In the meeting in North Carolina, he felt compelled not to speak against slavery, even though the matter was important to him, because the journey itself had occasioned a new understanding of what faithfulness required in that moment. As he wrote of a separate journey, quote, "It was my concern from day to day to say no more nor less than what the Spirit of Truth opened in me." He believed that in his attention to God's leading on the inward landscape of his soul, just as he felt he had followed God's leading across the geographic landscape of the southern colonies, he was connected mystically to a spiritual reality that perceived truths imperceptible to human wisdom. His silence was vindicated, and his union with a higher wisdom made obvious, he believed, by the stream of voices that spoke in support of reforming slavery after he had decided God wanted him not to speak. He implied that had he decided to speak, the local voices would not have done so, and the cause of anti-slavery among the Southern Quakers would have been hindered. While Woolman's journey in the South had increased his sensitivity to the spiritual leadings of God so as not to speak unless led to do so, the Southern friend who did speak had himself discerned his conviction on a, quote, solitary journey, as had the following account from Virginia. In the three accounts of Woolman's own decision and the discerned convictions of the two Southern friends, spatial movement was intertwined with particular divine revelations. Woolman believed that the physical act of travel on one hand and divine revelation on the other hand were mutually reinforcing dynamics. In the physical space occasioned during times of travel, Woolman dwelled mystically in the direct inward revelation of Christ addressed into social structures like slavery. And by mystical, I mean that Woolman believed God's, quote, principle to be inwardly present in such a way that he could hear and obey God perfectly, so that the spiritual motion of God's leadings became the normative standards for the spatial motions of his physical body. Woolman's inclusion of these accounts in his journal served a pedagogical purpose. He believed that spiritual journeys into new situations and places could be a means of religious formation, perhaps because the silence and motion afforded in the act of travel in some ways reenacted on a spatial plane the spiritual listening and motion into God of Quaker worship. Woolman believed the task of the minister was that of stepping into the role of a prophet. He did not just leave on a journey, he adopted a new persona. During his 1757 travel into the South, he wrote that in following God in absolute obedience, the minister could be, quote, united to God and speak God's word to the people. Quote, traveling up and down of late, I have had renewed evidences that to be faithful to the Lord and content with his will concerning me is a most necessary and useful lesson for me to be learning, looking less at the effects of my labor than at the pure motion and reality. And as the mind, by a humble resignation, is united to him, and we utter words from an inward knowledge that they arise from the heavenly spring, though our way may be difficult and require close attention to keep in it, and though the manner in which we may be led may tend to our abasement, yet if we continue in patience and meekness, heavenly peace is the reward of our labors. For Woolman to leave his home in New Jersey as a traveling minister was to place himself in a vulnerable position before God and others. As he traveled, he thought he learned what God desired and how to speak, quote, from an inward knowledge, that his words were of God. He believed that his works were the works of God's kingdom, and through his faithfulness, the kingdom of God could, quote, spread and prevail. By the mid-1760s, Woolman came to attribute theological significance not just to the act of travel, but to the mode of travel as well. In the early 1760s, Woolman began wearing undyed clothing as a sign against excess and waste and the oppression that arose therein. On journeys to Maryland in 1766 and 1767, as well as while traveling in England in 1772, Woolman felt God leading him to travel by foot. The act of walking not only provided solitude for contemplation, he also believed, quote, that by so traveling, I might have a more lively feeling of the condition of the oppressed slaves, set an example of lowliness before the eyes of their masters, and be more out of temptation to unprofitable familiarities. Woolman claimed that walking as a mode of travel intensified his prophetic experience while traveling. As he matured and his itinerant ministry expanded geographically, Woolman also insinuated that the revelation of Christ expanded and made new demands on his life, dress, and mode of travel. The spiritual, quote, sorrow and heaviness Woolman felt when he encountered slavery on his 1767 journey in Maryland corresponded with the physical fatigue of traveling on foot. Quote, though traveling on foot was wearisome to my body, yet thus traveling was agreeable to the state of my mind. The act of walking alone and the self-humiliation of contradicting Quaker norms by wearing undyed clothing arose from Woolman's obedience to his feeling of God's leading, which also intensified the aesthetics of his embodiment of divine leading as he became more distinctive in appearance. Woolman's critique of slavery and luxury consumption cut to the heart of the burgeoning transatlantic marketplace economy, which thrived off of the labor of slaves and the affluence of the merchant class. Woolman was not the only minister who corresponded mode of travel with message. While traveling in Maryland in 1798, New Jersey Quaker Joshua Evans, who also wore undyed clothing, expressed concern that Quaker ministers in Baltimore might hinder their ministry because of the carriage they chose to travel in. He wrote, "I stayed several days in Baltimore and had some profitable labor in several families, pointing out diverse things inconsistent with the testimony of truth and the profession we are making. I likewise had a solid conference with some friends who were going on a religious visit and expressed my concern that precept and example might in all things correspond, for I thought the carriage in which they proposed to ride savored too much of fashion according to the custom of the world." It's informative that Woolman's concern to travel on foot in the ministry did not extend to his home life, for he expressed no conviction against traveling by horse when occasion arose at home. Likewise, Evans draws attention to the use of the carriage on a religious visit, not the impropriety of the carriage itself. Neither Woolman nor Evans could separate the activity of the minister from the outward aesthetics of travel. Woolman believed the aesthetics of his travel corresponded with the inward dynamics of spiritual and moral formation and revealed divine truths to his fellow colonists, the people who witnessed him traveling. Thus, the outward and physical appearance and motions of his body took on symbolic significance that corresponded with the kingdom he thought God had revealed to him. In his role as a traveling minister, he desired to embrace the corporate identity and the ethical standards God commissioned him to proclaim. Woolman's fellow citizens struggled to understand the preacher who, dressed in white, walked hundreds of miles and entered hostile lands. Woolman's very visible presence was a stinging rebuke to the prosperity of the colonial ruling class. The aesthetics of Woolman's itinerant ministry, though, begin to come into focus when one considers Woolman's mysticism, in which a state of union with God was revealed in the spiritual, quote, motion of love that in turn prompted physical motion. The redeemed society was to come about as faithful ministers looked to the inward teacher who would recreate the world according to God's kingdom. Traveling miles and miles of road and sea, Woolman gave attention to the interplay between spiritual space and physical space, not just in the fields around him, but on his own body. In his mystical attachment to God's voice and the aesthetics of his travel, Woolman wished to be a symbol and harbinger of the alternative ordering God had ordained for the world. Woolman's example indicates that the intensity of the journey, whether spiritual, physical, or emotional, affects the experience of the journey. Moreover, Woolman's dedication to the vocation of itinerant minister is a glimpse of the way creating spiritual space in the solitude of travel and pursuing exposure to the other facilitated spiritual and ethical formation in the traveler. This analysis suggests that scholars can learn much about the experience of travelers by taking into account the traveler's theology and understanding of God's intent for social organization. Likewise, examining Woolman from the perspective of spiritual and ethical formation reveals new insight into colonial Quaker understandings of God's work within history and illumines Quaker visions of the transformed society.
I think because we're recording, you're going to do the questions straight after, if that's all right. Mm-hmm. So does anyone have any questions for John? Thank you very much for
fascinating. How are you using the word aesthetics? Can you define that a little more?
Well, in this case, I'm using aesthetics as the visible representation of his body, the symbolic mode of travel.
Would symbolism be as effective
as
the
aesthetics?
Word aesthetics? Anyway, I'll just raise that.
Yeah, I'm not sure because he didn't necessarily, in the occasion of walking, for example, he wasn't making a direct symbolic link, but certainly in that case, his own appearance as a traveling minister seems like it might be more part of the aesthetics.
The context makes it quite clear. It's just when you hear the word aesthetics, you know, you sort of think of beauty a little bit.
Mm.
But anyway.
In a very Quaker, subdued kind of way.
And maybe a very stupid question, but do you know if Mahatma Gandhi knew about women?
Hmm.
Because what you're describing is basically what happened in India in the 20s. Well, when Gandhi came back to India in about the 20s, deciding to dress as the poorest of the poorest, because it's probably pointless to be with the elite in Bombay and ignoring the rest of the continent and saying, you know, and dyeing your clothes because. Anyway, the cotton is coming from Manchester,
mm-hmm.
and it's ruining the economy. So I don't know. I mean, obviously, I know Quakers welcome Gandhi in the UK in one visit, if I believe so.
I think, I'm pretty certain Gandhi did know about women, but I'm not sure when Gandhi knew. Do you know, Betty?
That would be my feeling as well. I mean, I'm reasonably certain from things I've read that he did, but I don't know
at what
point
stage
in his own journey he read women. And I would have thought as well that, for instance, when Gandhi came to Woodbrook and things, that, you know, it would have been one of the writers the Quakers would have been directing him towards if he hadn't.
How does, I don't know if this is an answerable question, how does the idea of God moving you to speak or not to speak actually work out in practice? I'm thinking that when you decide not to join in against slavery at a particular point, and another point that you might, has much been written on how you know, is it just a hunch?
Right.
Is there any kind of verification or any kind of support? I know I don't think God thinks that way today.
Right, yeah. Woolman talks about this process he undergoes, and he describes it a process of resignation. And now besides what all the stages in that are, he's not very clear, but the way he describes it is that as he resigns himself to God's will, you know, which is a big question, how does that happen? Then it becomes clear what he's to do. There's an interesting example from 1768 in which he was debating whether or not to travel to Barbados. And this is another example I could have used. He wanted to travel to Barbados. All the ships going from the Philadelphia area to Barbados were, in one way or another, involved in the slave trade. And so he was kind of like, how does he go on this ministry journey that he's wondering if it's something he needs to do without then like actually tainting himself by becoming involved in the slave trade as a passenger on a slave?
Yeah.
I mean, how does he keep himself? I mean, he just found that the transatlantic marketplace and the slave trade was so entrenched in society that he had to really question his own, every step of his own actions. Over a period of several months, he mentions in his journal several times that he wanted to be resigned to go to Barbados. And there's some, as a Quaker practice, in order to travel as a minister, he would go before the governing body and ask for a traveling certificate. And there's several cases where, or at least one case where he got his traveling certificate and it was in the meeting minutes and it said that John Woolman was to go to Barbados. And then somebody added in later, John Woolman would be resigned to go to Barbados. So it was he had a really complicated process of not knowing whether or not he should go to Barbados, but wanting to be resigned to go to Barbados. After he was resigned to go to Barbados, it became clear he wasn't supposed to go to Barbados in his mind. But then
he had to go through that stage of being willing.
But he had to go through the stage
of
being willing or surrender, you know, and then just 4 years later he sailed to England, and there wasn't much of this to do about this long process of being willing to go to Barbados or the being resigned to go.
The other thing is to say, yes, there are some things written about the process.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So, could you say more? You said, you mentioned early in your talk that somebody talked about reformist ministers like Woolman as a minority voice with disproportionate powers within the Quaker organization. Can you say more about Woolman's relationship to the Quaker organization, you know, in terms of what you're talking about, you know, here following God's motions and so forth?
Yeah, about the time of the 1740s, a group of Quakers who have been called Quaker Reformers or part of the Quaker Reformation in Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. They were a group of fairly like-minded Quakers who had the vision of reforming Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. And in their thought, it had become too worldly. And one prime example of that was that these reform ministers really cracked down on the practice of exogamy, marrying outside of the meeting. Marrying outside the meeting had been a very profitable means of adding numbers to the Quaker rolls, adding money, adding business. It was very good for the standings of the merchant Quaker elite. So these Quaker reformers had a very vigorous traveling ministry in which they held together like far-flung meetings who might have one or two kind of reform-minded members. But they traveled so much that it's almost like they became the consensus voice, even though they were always the minority voice, but they just were very active. And they were also the ones who would be up for denominational positions and who wrote denominational epistles and documents. And so starting in the 1740s and then all the way, probably by the 1780s, we can say that they were in control of Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. And so that's called the Quaker Reformation. Woolman, my contention is that Woolman theologically was different than many of his fellow reformers, but socially he was very alike. And so he formed alliances readily with these other ministers. They worked together. The record of who he traveled with, the same names keep popping up. It was a network of traveling ministers who kind of all had the same ideals. And they might have come to their positions sooner or later. For example, Woolman came to his anti-war position a little bit later than some others, but was early on the anti-slavery aspect and helped move some of the anti-war reformers to become also anti-slavery reformers. So there was kind of that dynamic in which these reform-minded friends were shaping each other and then reforming the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting.
And travel was, for the Quaker Reformation people, travel was an important part of the way that they gained power and significance within the organization.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I mean, they would go to the meetings and just to make sure that the discipline was being followed. It was a way of seeing where the weaknesses were, in their opinion, in the yearly meeting, as well as making sure everybody knew that the yearly meeting had put out this document and wanted the meeting to respond on moral questions. So travel was very important.
As a means, as you used the word. Did you use the word discipline? Like travel as a way of keeping discipline among a far flung sect domination. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. Thank you very much. Thank you, John.
All right.